Welcome back once again, everyone, for our last but certainly not least of our sessions. Gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Katie Harling Lee, whose career has had a remarkably interesting trajectory, one I'm very fond of hearing about. She began in my field as an Old Norse scholar, sort, and is currently a British Academy postdoctoral fellow at the University of Edinburgh, researching a fascinating project at the School of Divinity on silence, if I'm correct. And she is also speaking today on what I consider one of the most underrated and unspoken of authors when it comes to the fantasy genre, MacDonald. I love MacDonald, and I think more people should speak about him. So, thrilled to hear what you've got to say.
Thank you very much for the introduction. So, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for still being here today, so late in the day. So, I'm just getting all my timers and things set up here. So, essentially, today my talk is titled 19th Century Fantasy, The Influences of Morris and MacDonald. And there is a dual meaning behind this title that I've got here. So, I'm going to refer to some of the earlier texts and cultural traditions which influenced William Morris and George MacDonald, but I'm also going to be looking forward to the 20th century as well, and to fantasy authors who were themselves influenced by these two foundational authors in the world of fantasy fiction. Hence these kind of two meanings of influence we've got going on here, moving between past and future. And just in this introduction, it was mentioned my kind of intriguing trajectory here. So I started Old Norse, I went into contemporary fiction, looking at music in contemporary fiction. Then I've been covering, the reason I'm here is because I was covering a class on the making of modern fantasy. So with that, I'm bringing my Old Norse interest to look at Morris. And then I've recently started a new project at the School of Divinity in Edinburgh, so which is in religion and literature. So that kind of bringing that to MacDonald. So I hope you enjoy my kind of slightly, lots of little different pieces we're going to look at today for you to understand the world of 19th century fiction. So, here we go. So first of all, trajectory for today. The idea is this is very much a bridging talk. I'm very much want to bring you to finish the day today as you've been hearing a lot of the history, all of these legacies, and then as we move tomorrow into kind of Lewis and Tolkien and beyond. So I'm just going to have kind of a whistle-stop tour today that we're going to take, but this is where we're going. So first of all, we'll have just a brief overview of the context of the 19th century. This is to help place us in a context often dominated by Victorian realist novels, but was also a foundational moment for modern fantasy literature. I will then briefly introduce you to William Morris and George MacDonald, who are the two authors I will focus on today, though I will be making reference to other well-known fantasy authors as and when relevant. The talk proper will then begin as I focus first on William Morris and his use of Old Norse heroics in one of his novels, The Glittering Plain, which was first published in 1891. And as Morris had many interests, I will also cover some of these briefly just to give you an idea of his very polymath tendencies. From Morris, we then turn to George MacDonald, and who wrote two informative essays on the imagination, which I'm going to refer to, alongside quite a wild and wacky 1895 novel, Lilith, as my example. I'm also going to refer to MacDonald's Christian religious perspective, which is central to his fantasy fiction, which makes him as a precursor and, in fact, a key inspiration for C.S. Lewis and his, for example, more religious fantasy series, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I'm then going to finish with what I'm calling my concluding remarks, as I draw together some of the key points of interest in my talk today, bearing in mind the work of Morris and MacDonald as we look forward to the burgeoning fantasy literature of the 20th and 21st centuries. Now, amidst this trajectory, we're also going to briefly... So I've also interspersed my discussion of Morris and MacDonald with a number of moments I've titled Looking Forwards. So these sections will allow us to briefly glimpse how the popular fantasy texts that we might know today can be traced back to these early 19th century authors who were at the forefront of a period that's often considered to be the birth of modern fantasy, even if some of you may not have actually come across their work. So, first of all, 19th century context. So when we refer to the 19th century in literary studies, it's often in reference to what is known as the Victorian period. So this in turn may likely encourage you to think of the realist works of famous Victorian authors like Charles Dickens, George Eliot, Elizabeth Gaskell. But in contrast to this kind of dominant literary tradition of realist novels, in an age which valued scientific and logical approaches, the Victorian period was also the time of significant development in the genre of fantasy literature, as we understand it today. So many identify the 19th century as a key foundational moment for the making of modern fantasy. Even as scholars may also note that the broader concept of the fantastic has existed in world literature and myth centuries before that time, as we've been hearing about today. So it's therefore the fantasy genre that was kind of being formed, which itself stemmed from three popular literary traditions of the time. So we have going on in the 19th century, we have fictional private histories. So for example, Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe. We then have Gothic romances as well. So thinking about the Brontes. And then there's also, as we've been hearing, a renewed interest in folk and fairy tales. So thinking of the Brothers Grimm, for example. However, this Victorian period, while it was witness to like this, to these development of genres, it was also witness to the counter-development of fantastical literature in contrast to the dominant realist fiction of the day. And this fantastical literature, however, was often sidelined, and then a further tension developed. So we have this question where, for when fantasy literature was considered successful at the time, it was often understood as children's literature. So we have Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, Charles Kingsley's Water Babies, and often, if it's successful, it's for children, and so a tension arises. Is it for children? Is it for adults? Can it be for both? So in response to this marginalizing of adult fantasy literature, I present to you today two authors who passionately argued for the value of adult fantasy alongside children's fantasy, William Morris and George MacDonald. So let me introduce you to them. Now, we've heard a little bit about William Morris Day already, but here we have William Morris on the left. He was a remarkable polymath. So you may be more familiar with his wallpaper designs. Have I got some people more aware of that? Yeah, so it's the same William Morris. He did lots of things. He was also a poet, an author, a translator of Old Norse literature, an active socialist, and just to name kind of a few of his many callings. So that's William Morris. On the right, we have George MacDonald. So he was a Scottish author, poet, and a Congregational minister. And there's an important detail which influences fantasy work, as we'll see later in today's talk. Now, despite some differences in style and also a more kind of atheist, theist philosophies and ethics, both authors did share a core belief in the value of fantasy, or fairy stories, as they called them, for adults as well as children. So as MacDonald wrote, there's a quote at the top here, "I do not write for children, but the childlike, whether of 5 or 50 or 75. This idea was later echoed by C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien. So we come here first to my first looking forwards moment to see how these ideas are beginning with Morris and MacDonald, but then we can see this in the 20th century. So I've included a quotation from each author here, both in the essays on stories or fairy stories. This is first from C.S. Lewis, who wrote, "It is usual to speak in a playfully apologetic tone about one's adult enjoyment of what are called children's books. I think the convention is a silly one. No book is really worth reading at the age of 10, which is not equally, and often far more, worth reading at the age of 50. So that's C.S. Lewis's opinion there. And then we have J.R. Tolkien. "In my opinion, fairy stories should not be especially associated with children. Fairy stories offer fantasy, recovery, escape, consolation, all things of which children have as a rule less need than older people." So these quotations are demonstrating kind of a shared theme here that originated in the 19th century concerning the value of fantasy literature, a topic which is still debated today, we can probably agree. Now, these quotations also bring me to another point just to be aware of. We've heard a bit of this in Roz's talk just now, but the use of fairy stories rather than fantasy here. So the authors I'm speaking about were at the forefront of modern fantasy. The term fantasy was not pervasive, and the authors in their essays often refer to fairy stories as well. So for simplicity's sake, I'm referring to their texts as fantasy today, just in my attempt to show you briefly how these foundational works can be read as forming the foundation of what we consider today modern fantasy literature. But it is useful to be aware of the shifting terminology in the fantasy genre and its history. So I turn now to my first author of focus, William Morris. So as I was just mentioning, The debate about whether fantasy stories were for children or adults, or both, was growing in the 19th century, and Morris was one of those who argued for the value of adult fantasy fiction. He did this in one way by writing his own fantasy works, and the one I'm speaking about today is still called The Story of the Glittering Plain. So the cover is just up here. Morris, befitting his polymath tendencies, was interested in the entire object of the book. So it's not just writing the text, but also designing and crafting the physical object which contained his text, including illustration. And this led to a number of editions of The Glittering Plain, which was also the first book to be published by the Kelmscott Press, which Morris co-founded. So I'm going to be talking about that a little bit more a bit later as well, but I just wanted to flag that up because you can see this very intricate design coming up on the drawings here to kind of demonstrate the art of bookmaking. So first, though, I'm going to focus on the heroic plot of the novel. So has anyone here read The Glittering Plain? I'm expecting a few, of one or two. Okay, great. So essentially, here's the in brief for those who haven't read it, which is most of us here. So the story of The Glittering Plain tells the heroic tale of Hallblithe of the House of the Raven, who travels to the Isle of Ransom and the Acre of Undying, also known as The Glittering Plain, to save his kidnapped fiance, who is known simply as the hostage. So the tale is chiefly concerned with a tension between human mortality and then the common desire for immortality, hence the glittering plain, this acre of the undying. Morris approaches this through a heroic ethic, which is both a seed for our contemporary understanding of heroic deeds in fantasy literature, as well as being directly inspired by medieval sources. Most importantly, heroic deeds became more powerful in Morris's work precisely because of one's mortality. It is through a sense of peril that heroic actions can be taken, and then one's immortality can actually be achieved not physically, but through the heroic stories of myth and legend, which can be passed down the generations. So I mentioned in my introduction that fantasy literature of the 19th century draws from three popular literary traditions, often merging them. And one of these included this revived interest in folk and fairy stories. But for Morris, this also included the heroic literature of, from Old Norse traditions, also Old Icelandic, and the broader Germanic North as well. So Morris developed his interest in Old Norse literature by translating it himself, although with the help and guidance of an Icelandic scholar, Erika Magnusson. And Old Norse literature generally consists of two key genres. We can say, we're talking about prose sagas, and then we can talk about heroic or mythic poetry. Morris was fascinated with both of these, but it is the sagas that I will introduce you to today, as we can see the impact of his translation work on The Glittering Plain. And for as an example, I'm going to compare the first lines of The Glittering Plain with those from a selection of Old Norse sagas. So to begin, here's the opening of The Glittering Plain. It has been told that there was once a young man of free kindred and whose name was Hallblithe. He was fair, strong, and not untried in battle. He was of the House of the Raven of old time. So note here, as I've underlined, the clear statements. Immediately we're told the hero's name, we're told that he's fair and strong and battle experienced, and we have the family ties to the House of the Raven. We've also been set in a context of old stories. It has been told. So in comparison, here are now some examples from some Old Norse sagas. So this is Njal's saga, written around the 13th century. There was a man named Mord, whose nickname was Gia. He was a son of Sigvat the Red, and he lived at Vot in the Rangavetla district. He was a powerful chieftain and strong in pressing lawsuits. So again, we have immediately entered the past through there was here. We're told the names of a man and his family, and we know that he was powerful. And side note, Njal's saga is fascinating in terms of its engagement with lawsuits. But here's another example, this one from Eyl's saga. There was a man named Ulf, the son of Bialthi and of Hathbera. Ulf was so big and strong that no man was a match for him, and he was still only a youth when he became a Viking and went raiding. So again, we have a there was construction. We are introduced to Ulf and his family line, and we know that he was big, a big, strong Viking with fighting prowess. Here's one more example, quite brief, from the Saga of the Volsungs, which Morris himself was also quite fascinated with and translated and retold. Here we begin by telling of a man who was named Sigi, and it was said that he was the son of Odin. So once again, we're entering the past, kind of here we begin. We have a name and we have a sense of greatness here through a connection with Odin. Now, I'm hoping that these brief examples will help you see the patterns here, but to remind you, let's have the glittering plane opening line again. So that should be here. It has been told there was a young man, and so on. So Old Norse sagas have a distinct narrative structure, one which makes them very compelling, and I have quite an interest for them. And Morris is clearly drawing on these older texts, using their older styles as inspiration for his newer fantasy genre, which, however new, yearns towards a concept of the past. However, despite these similarities, Morris is also making it new with his fantasy literature, because there is a difference between his first line and those of the sagas I've just shown you. Now, all of the sagas I've given you begin by naming characters who are not what we might call the main characters. Instead, they are the fathers or grandfathers or great-great-grandfathers of the titular characters. So in an Old Norse saga, we often do not meet the main character until many pages into the book. Morris, however, cuts to the chase and introduces Hallblithe, the hero of his tale, immediately. So this is where we have a sense that Morris is drawing from this older tradition, but he's also experimenting with it, making something new from drawing from these older traditions. Now, there is more to Morris's medieval borrowing. He also drew from these tales and ethics of brotherhood and the heroic. For example, I'm actually going to show you two scenes side by side that demonstrate how Morris has actually lifted an Old Norse brotherhood ritual and inserted it into the narrative of the Glittering Plain. So first, his from the Glittering Plain, he had loosened a strip of turf, all save the two ends, and had propped it up with two ancient dwarf-wart spears, so that amidmost there was a lintel to go under. They went under the earth yoke one after the other. Thereafter they stood together, and each let blood in his arm, so that the blood of all three mingled together, fell down on the grass of the ancient earth, and they swore friendship and brotherhood. Now, I know I have some Old Norse scholars here, but does anyone guess what saga this is lifted from? Anyone tell? So, Gisli Sursson's saga has this. So I've kind of underlined and put in color here to show you the similarities. Obviously, there'll be differences across translations, but this gives us a sense. So they scored out a long strip of turf, making sure that both ends were still attached to the ground. Then they propped up the arch of raised turf with a Damascene spear, so long-shafted that the man could stretch out his arm and touch the rivets. All four of them had to go under it. They drew blood and let it drip down on the soil beneath this turf strip and stirred it together, the soil and the blood. Then they all swore an oath that each would avenge the other as if they were brothers. So you can see this with the color match phrases, but for example, we've got the strip of turf, the spears that went under, letting blood, swore an oath, and so on. And this is kind of a ritual that we don't know too much about, but Morris is lifting this from here. And it's an example of him using the Old Norse texts and really putting them into his texts. Structurally, however, there are differences between these examples, even though he's lifting a lot of it. And that comes with the wider narrative context. So the example in Gisli's saga is actually near the beginning of the narrative, and it's a brotherhood ritual that is interrupted and used to establish a saga drama to come as brotherhood ties are broken and a lot of vengeance is taken. There's a lot of one killing another. In contrast, Morris inserts his brotherhood vision near the end of his tale. He's cementing relationships which have been formed over the course of the narrative. By then, they form this brotherhood ritual. So again, Morris is drawing on an older tradition, but he's also using them to communicate his own concept of a heroic narrative here. Now, on this topic of the heroic, Morris also establishes a clear heroic impulse in his tale, a familiar theme of modern fantasy literature, yet also another one which we can trace back to these medieval texts. So the first lines I read out earlier were from the sagas and from the Glittering Plain, already established that to be heroic is to be strong. So to be fierce in battle. This warrior impulse and its interaction with mortality and immortality comes through once again in some lines I'm about to read from the Glittering Plain. So for context, Hallblithe here has entered into the Glittering Plain, the land of the undying, and he's speaking to a man, a chieftain known as the Sea Eagle, who was old and dying and has now been returned to youthfulness after entering the Glittering Plain, which is an immortal land. And he says to him, "O Eagle of the Sea, thou hast thy youth again. What then wilt thou do with it? What art thou, O warrior, in the land of the alien and the king? Who shall heed thee or tell the tale of thy glory? Here stand I, Hallblithe of the Raven, and I am come into an alien land beset with marvels to seek mine own. So see how Hallblithe is speaking and how he's concerned with deeds of glory here, to be achieved in youthful heroics and then retold in tales passed down to generations. He seeks to have the tale of his glory told. So this example here, which we can trace to medieval texts, but I'm actually going to use it now to go to another look forwards moment, because we can find a similar heroic impulse and desire for tales of glory in the works of Tolkien and Le Guin. So for example, in Lord of the Rings, Sam says to Frodo, "I wonder if we will ever be put into songs or tales. We're in one, of course, but I mean put into words, you know, told by the fireside or read out of a great big book." Wonderful meta moment in Lord of the Rings. Likewise, in Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea Cycle, which I love, everyone should read, it tells of how songs made 100 years ago were news to those villages, and they craved to hear of heroes. And within Le Guin's kind of world building, she also does an interesting thing where she takes a heroic impulse and develops it into an understanding of one's deeper self. So, for example, the heroes, the ones who seek to be themselves, to be oneself is a rare thing and a great one. So as well as we've got Le Guin's development of a heroic ethic in relation to personal identity here, there is actually another difference between this example and Morris's text. I'm wondering if you've spotted this difference. I'm going to put Morris's quotation up again. So here we go. It is Morris's use of archaisms. Note here the thou, hast, and thy. The wilt thou do, what are thou, O warrior? These are examples of Morris's own use of his own archaic style, what some might consider affected and false, and others will enjoy. But there is a recurring tendency in fantasy to use archaic or pseudo-archaic phrases and structures to try and create a sense of a land long ago, like the old medieval tales that Morris is drawing from. So it's this idea of using the archaic to say, look, we're really obviously in the old times here. We've got a different language going on. So the quotations from Tolkien and Le Guin don't have those constructions there. In fact, Le Guin even critiqued this archaic tendency of fantasy writers in one of her essays. So again, we're looking forwards here. Le Guin writes, "The archaic manner is a trap into which almost all very young fantasy writers walk. They know instinctively that what is wanted in fantasy is a distancing from the ordinary. The archaic manner is indeed a perfect distancer, but you have to do it perfectly." So Le Guin is using here the term distancer, and distance is precisely what Morris was aiming for in his writing, drawing as he was from medieval Old Norse tales, amongst other traditions too. Morris is harking back to an older age, and he wanted that to be understood in terms of his story content and his language, and even in the way he illustrated his book, which I will get onto briefly. But Le Guin does suggest that archaisms don't have to be required of fantasy literature, and she writes, "After all, archaisms are not essential. You don't have to know how to use a subjunctive in order to be a wizard. You don't have to talk like Henry V to be a hero." So I'm showing this to you to kind of see how, we can see how Morris, in his role as an early pre-runner of modern fantasy, valued archaisms in his writing, but also how this isn't necessarily remained a requirement for all modern fantasy, even as it does recur. It's also a useful example of the process of making modern fantasy, how the genre is drawing on earlier traditions, but it's also gradually building confidence and experimentation in establishing its own contemporary outlook on what fantasy means to it. So, I have one more aspect of Morris to discuss before moving to MacDonald, and that is the object of a book as a work of art, which I mentioned briefly at the start with my introduction to Morris. So one of Morris's many talents and interests included his work as part of the arts and crafts movement. He also trained as a painter and then as an architect, and all of his work and more led to his belief in the importance of useful tools also being beautiful aesthetically. Thus, he proposed that books should be beautiful too. And in a lecture, he suggested that, in fact, a book, printed or written, has a tendency to be a beautiful object, and that we of this age should generally produce ugly books shows, I fear, something like malice prepense. Now, importantly for Morris, amidst this idea of the beautiful book, there's the picture book. So the picture book is not perhaps absolutely necessary to man's life, but it gives us such endless pleasure and is so intimately connected with the other absolutely necessary art of imaginative literature that it must remain one of the very worthiest things towards the production of which reasonable men should strive. So Morris's picture book here brings us back to the importance of fantasy for adults as well as for children. Morris is enacting and then enacts this belief in beautiful books for adults with the Kelmscott Press, where he published The Glittering Plain. So as a further example of this, I've now got the opening pages of The Glittering Plain up here. So you can see this intricacy. And you can access this book online on the Internet Archive, wonderful website, if you want to look through all the pages. So note just here, we've got intricate patterns of vines. We've got detailed drawings here. This one detailed drawing is the chapter heading. This is the beginning of the book, but each chapter has a detailed drawing that comes up. And even in between the sentences, you can see one of them here, there's a little leaf sometimes appears between the text. So it's very much the whole page is becoming beautiful and illustrated. I think it's interesting to consider Morris's ideas about the ideal book, bearing in mind today's publishing trend for beautiful books, including special editions featuring sprayed edges and gold foil details. And it's also interesting with the fantasy genre specifically, because we consider the importance of illustrations to help conjure a secondary world, or through maps and as well and images and fantastical creatures. So I think that's just an interesting element we might be able to link back or parallel with Morris there. But we can also look forward from Morris and his artistic interest to the fantasy work of Lord Dunsany, an early 20th century fantasy author who wrote The King of Elfland's Daughter, which was mentioned briefly today. Has anyone read The King of Elfland's Daughter? A couple, okay. It's a very beautifully poetic book. So in there, visual art is actually central to the imagery of Dunsany's world building, with some actually reading the magic of Elfland as a manifestation of art. So this is Augusta Hardy. But there's another visual link between Dunsany and Morris that I found, and that's the concept of the blue of distance. So if people haven't heard of that, the blue of distance was written about by Rebecca Solnit, who writes, "The color blue is the color that represents the spirit, the sky, and water, the immaterial and the remote, so that however tactile and close up it is always about distance and disembodiment." So here I'm now going to include two examples, one from The Glittering Plain, one from Elfland, that demonstrate this use of blue of distance as a visual representation of the remote, but described in the literary text, to show that just out of reach world of fairy tale or fantasy world. So first, from The Glittering Plain. "In the offing looking landward were great mountains, some very great and snow-capped, some bare to the tops, and all that was far away, save the snow, was deep blue." And then we have in Elfland. "At the evening, he looked to see the elfin mountains, severe and changeless, until unlit by any light we know, the color of pale forget-me-nots." So here is just a little hint at this kind of how the visual and the world of art can also be important to the fantastical world building that we've got here. I'm showing this as another example of this blurring together of traditions and interests and artistic styles that Morris was kind of bringing together in his very polymath approach to his work. So in summary, Morris's work is influenced by a number of ideas, including the ancient world of medieval Old Norse sources from which he drew ideas from, including the love of heroic deeds, which rely on one's physical mortality to achieve on immortality through stories. He also influenced later writers in terms of the book being a work of art, which itself likely stemmed from medieval manuscript traditions. And then we have his interest in visual art and the way that visuals come to play in The Glittering Plain that can be paralleled with the slightly later work of Dunsany. So the series of influences demonstrates the polymath tendencies of Morris, but also the polymath tendencies of fantasy literature in the 19th century more generally. It was a genre that draws together multiple narrative traditions alongside history, art, and as we're now going to see in MacDonald's work, philosophy and religion as well. So here is the wonderful cover of Lilith that I have. It's not the original one, but it's quite a wild one. So has anyone here read Lilith? Okay, couple. Has anyone heard of Lilith? Okay, a few, okay. So first published in 1895, Lilith. For a bit of background, The novel's title refers to the mythical and folkloric character of Lilith, who is generally understood as a demon from Jewish folklore, in which she actually precedes Eve in the Garden of Eden. So, using Lilith to explore the concept of evil, MacDonald narrates a fantasy tale that is centered on his belief in the possibility of redemption for all, stemming from his experience as a Christian minister. So, but before we get into the complexities of that, Lilith begins, with in a rather familiar world with our protagonist, Mr. Vane, who has returned home. So I'm just going to read the opening line to give you a sense of what we begin with. I had just finished my studies at Oxford and was taking a brief holiday from work before assuming definitely the management of the estate. My father died when I was yet a child. My mother followed him within a year, and I was nearly as much alone in the world as a man might find himself. Now, from this rather familiar beginning, we might think of a realist novel here of the Victorian period, things become stranger and stranger. So, this starts with Mr. Vane's wandering through a mirror and finding himself in an open plains. This is our portal fantasy, talking to a raven. So here I'm going to read a little of the passage, which takes place just in chapter 3 of the book. "How did I get here?" I said. "You came through the door," replied an odd, rather harsh voice. I looked behind, then all about me, but saw no human shape. The terror that madness might be at hand laid hold upon me. The same instant I knew it was the raven that had spoken, for he stood looking up at me with an air of waiting. I beg my reader to aid me in the endeavour to make myself intelligible, if here understanding be indeed possible between us. I was in a world, or call it a state of things, an economy of conditions, an idea of existence, so little correspondent with the ways and modes of this world. So the phrasing that MacDonald uses here, Mr. Vane's concern with trying to describe the indescribable, is the beginning of many similar moments, as he uses the fantasy genre to explore a world that may be beyond full human comprehension. And as the narrative progresses, Mr. Vane walks through mirrors and doorways, which turn out to be portals into another world that gradually gets more and more blurred. And then the fantasy world also gets stranger and stranger, and Mr. Vane even meets Adam and Eve, becoming entangled in a world aiming towards Christian redemption, and that includes the redemption of the novel's key evil figure, Lilith. And just before I move on, just note, we've also got kind of the gothic sense here, the sense of, oh, the horror of what have I seen, and then we've shifted into the fantasy here. So the central tension of Lilith is a classic. It's good versus evil. MacDonald attempts to understand this tension through a Christian perspective. Now, strikingly, the novel does advance a message that evil cannot be killed. Instead, evil must be redeemed. And Mr. Raven explains this to Mr. Vane, explaining how Lilith, whose evil by this point in the book has manifested in a physical wound, might be saved. He says, "Nothing will ever close that wound," he answered with a sigh. "It must eat into her heart. Annihilation itself is no death to evil. Only good, where evil was, is evil dead. An evil thing must live with its evil until it chooses to be good. That alone is the slaying of evil." Now, many of you here today might hear echoes of more modern fantasy texts and films here, which speak of the importance of good triumphing over evil, of how light can transform the dark. But there's also echoes of biblical texts here, particularly in the way that the quotation from Lilith, "evil is not slain by the traditional sword, but a metaphorical kind of weapon of goodness." And that is reminiscent of language in the New Testament, where swords are beaten into plowshares. And here I have a quote from Ephesians, where the disciple of Christ is commanded that, "Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the powers of this dark world and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore, put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground. Stand firm, then, with the belt of truth buckled around your waist, and the breastplate of righteousness in place, and with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to this, take up the shield of faith, with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God." Note my bolder text here, so I've just used this to highlight the metaphorical armor of God here with which evil might be slain, but it's very much a reworking of the battle language into something different. So To better understand MacDonald's integration of religious concepts within his fantasy literature, we need to consider two informative essays which he wrote about imagination and its relationship with religion. So these were titled The Fantastic Imagination and then The Imagination, Its Function and Culture. So the title on the slide refers to which one I'm referring to, and they can both be read free online as well. So in one of them he proposes that to inquire into what God has made is the main function of the imagination. It is aroused by facts, is nourished by facts, seeks for higher and yet higher laws in those facts, but refuses to regard science as the sole interpreter of nature, or the laws of science as the only region of discovery. So MacDonald is proposing here that the imagination, central to the fantasy genre, can help us come closer to understanding the incomprehensibility of God. And note too here, he's having a reaction against the more realist or scientific focuses and tendencies of the time here, saying that it's not just the facts that can help us. So in this again, MacDonald is echoing a famous visual from the Bible, from 1 Corinthians. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as I am known. So this is this theme of trying to understand something beyond our comprehension. And the theme of incomprehensibility on this, think back to the lines I read earlier when Mr. Vane met the raven and enters a new world. His entry into a world where he knows nothing is MacDonald's attempt to see into that glass of God's incomprehensibility, and a glass is another word for a mirror, which MacDonald, the character, has just walked through. Now, importantly, tied with his imaginative attempt to understand God through fantasy literature, there's another important element of belief in imagination. So in Lilith, Mr. Raven advises us that the fact is no man understands anything. Neither I nor any man can help you to understand, but I may perhaps help you a little to believe. So these examples I've just given from Lilith demonstrate how MacDonald, by writing his fantasy fiction, becomes one of those who may help us a little to believe, as he writes. Now, because MacDonald believed that imagination can help lead us toward divine revelation and an understanding and kind of relationship with God, in turn that means that MacDonald was, like Morris, despite differences in religious approaches, a proponent for the importance of fairy tales for people, writing a warning in his essays on the imagination. He says, "Kill that whence spring the crude fancies and wild daydreams of the young, and you will never lead them beyond dull facts. Dull because their relations to each other and the one life that works in them all must remain undiscovered." So in summary here, with for MacDonald, the inspiration of the Almighty shapes imaginative literature, for MacDonald's view, and in fact brings humanity close to a godlike quality of creation. So as MacDonald writes, "The fantasy author may, if he pleases, invent a little world of his own with his own laws, for there is in that in him which delights in calling up new forms, which is the nearest, perhaps, he can come to creation." So such an idea, linking the fantasy author to the role of creator, brings a certain seriousness to fantasy literature and a sense of responsibility. And we can now look forwards from this, from MacDonald's intertwining of religion and fantasy literature to 20th century fantasy. So for example, we have C.S. Lewis, who was heavily influenced by MacDonald's work, and we can see that in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There's also a space trilogy. Has anyone read Space Trilogy? Have been clues for Alandra? Fascinating set of books. Now, Tolkien, too, also connected his religious convictions with his fantasy writing. And in his essay on fairy stories, which we heard a bit from earlier today, and in which, like Morris and MacDonald, he argues for the value of fantasy stories, fairy stories for both children and adults, Tolkien ends by coining a new term, eucatastrophe, to explain the importance of a happy ending. And this was hinted at on an earlier handout today. So I'm going to quote, "Most important is the consolation of a happy ending in fairy tales. I would venture to assert that all complete fairy stories must have it. I would say that tragedy is the true form of drama, its highest function. But the opposite is true of fairy story. Since we do not appear to possess a word that expresses this opposite, I will call it eucatastrophe. The eucatastrophic tale, which is always a tongue tie, is the true form of fairy tale and its highest function." So Tolkien's term here is deriving from the Greek for EU meaning good, and then there's an older understanding of catastrophe as just a sudden turn or a denouement or ending. Importantly for Tolkien, in this happy ending, this eucatastrophe, that according to Tolkien, the message of Christ can be read. So he wrote, "The consolation of fairy stories, the joy of the happy ending, or more correctly, the good catastrophe, the sudden joyous turn, is one of the things which fairy stories can produce supremely well, and is not essentially escapist. In its fairy tale or other world setting, it is a sudden and miraculous grace. It is evangelium, giving a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond walls of the world, poignant as grief." And for context here, evangelium means life and teaching of Christ. Now, Tolkien even goes so far as to claim that the Gospels contain a fairy story, or a story of a larger kind which embraces all the essence of fairy stories. The birth of Christ is the eucatastrophe of man's history. Therefore, Tolkien suggests that the Christian may dare to guess that in fantasy, he may actually assist in the enrichment of creation. I'm taking you through these kind of possibly more surprising sides to these authors, just to show how, like MacDonald, Tolkien makes use of the imaginary world of the fairy tale, of fantasy, to share a Christian message. As it is through fantasy's imaginative possibilities, we might catch a glimpse, if briefly, of the awe and wonder of God, who is incomprehensible and beyond full human comprehension. As Tolkien writes, "The peculiar quality of the joy in successful fantasy can thus be explained as a sudden glimpse of the underlying reality or truth, which is the message of God." And this returns us to that vision of the glass, the mirror in MacDonald, and the attempt to glimpse the divine through fantasy literature. Looking forwards, I just want to note that while we have the Christian concepts of fantasy literature can be seen in the work of Madeleine L'Engle, there's, for example, her series A Wrinkle in Time, if anyone has read that. But it's not just Christianity that we can find in fantasy. For example, we can consider Le Guin's Earthsea Cycle, where we're introduced not to a Christian perspective, but actually what some people have identified as a philosophical Taoism. And they kind of note this, that Taoism is central to the concept of creation in Earthsea, as shown in this quotation. So, "In the creation of Ea, which is the oldest song, it is said, only in silence the word, only in dark the light, only in dying life." So I just want to give that little hint there, that while I have focused on kind of this Christian view from these authors, particularly something from the 19th century, there's some interesting things to be done in terms of exploring lots of different religions here with fantasy. Something kind of an area I'm still exploring. So this religious turn brings me now to my concluding remarks for this talk today, as I end with a meditation on the concept of a moral imagination in fantasy literature. So at the beginning of today, Mendelssohn's pioneering Rhetorics of Fantasy was mentioned. And in there, she writes that fantasy, unlike science fiction, relies on a moral universe. It is less an argument with the universe than a sermon on the way things should be, a belief that the universe should yield to moral precepts. And moreover, she suggests that fantasy seeks to make the universe understandable in moral terms. Now, we can find this moral universe in MacDonald's work quite clearly through his explicit use of a fantasy story to explore the complex Christian concept of redemption, including by featuring the characters of Adam and Eve as he imagines them. And so in doing so, MacDonald forwards his belief in the value of a wise imagination, which he describes in an imagination essay. "In very truth, a wise imagination, which is the presence of the Spirit of God, is the best guide that man or woman can have. For it is not the things we see the most clearly that influence us the most powerfully. Undefined, yet vivid visions of something beyond have far more influence than any logical sequences whereby the same things may be demonstrated to the intellect." Now, if we then return to the glittering plain, religion there is quite absent. It's fitting Morris's more atheist outlook. Instead, in Morris's work, we could read a moral universe that combines a medieval heroic ethic with his 19th century socialist concerns, as well alongside his belief in the importance of both meaningful and beautiful objects and work. So we can see this in The Glittering Plain when Hallblithe, when he's stuck in the glittering plain, which is the Acre of the Undying, decides, figures out that the way he's going to escape is to build a boat. And so to do that, he has to spend many days building a boat by hand, which Morris narrates. And when Hallblithe is questioned by the immortal people living around him, the moral outlook of Morris's book becomes clearer, as he emphasizes the importance of finding meaning in one's work and also one's mortality. And they ask, "What shall all thy toil win thee?" they ask. And he spake Hallblithe, "Maybe a merry heart, or maybe death." So this is kind of our more earthly focus there in Morris, just to show you how you can get these different moral imaginations appearing in these texts. Now, although their moral outlooks may differ between the atheist and the theist, both MacDonald and Morris believed in the power of a fairy tale, of fantasy literature as we know it today, to create other worlds which might in turn impact the earthly world in which we exist. For these authors, fantasy was not simply an escape, but an imaginative opportunity for revisioning the world. It was the same for C.S. Lewis, who wrote, "The whole fantasy story, paradoxically enough, strengthens our relish for real life. This excursion into the preposterous sends us back with renewed pleasure to the actual." And then again with Le Guin, "Fantasy is a game played for the game's sake and a game played for very high stakes. It is a different approach to reality, an alternative technique for apprehending and coping with existence. It is not realistic, but surrealistic, super realistic, a heightening of reality." I will end now with a further comment from Le Guin, which ties together some of the themes of my talk today, focused on the role of the fantasy author and the act of creation. So Le Guin writes, "In fantasy, there is nothing but the writer's vision of the world. There is only a construct built in a void, with every joint and seam and nail exposed. To create what Tolkien calls a secondary universe is to make a new world. A world where no voice has ever spoken before, where the act of speech is the act of creation. The only voice that speaks there is the creator's voice, and every word counts." So Le Guin's words may remind us of a Christian story of creation, both in Genesis, when God said, "Let there be light," and there was light, and John 1, which begins, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God with God, and the Word was God." The fantasy author's voice, then, is contained in the written word or world, and therefore becomes an act of creation. As such, a sense of seriousness and responsibility is attributed to the role of the fantasy author, a seriousness that we can trace back to that early writing of William Morris and George MacDonald. These two authors who argued in their essays and demonstrated in their fiction for the importance of fairy tale or fantasy stories in the lives of both adults and children. So that brings me to the end of my talk. Thank you for listening to me. I hope this has brought a little light to the development of fantasy literature in the 19th century, which really did just cross disciplines and concepts and so on. So I hope that was a little taster for you all. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. That was a wonderful talk. We'll dive straight into questions. Do we have any from the floor? First hand up was over here.
Thank you so much. That was a wonderful presentation. Given that there's been a sort of effort to take fantasy more seriously for adults since the 19th century, do you have any thoughts on why maybe even in the present day fantasy seems sort of like a marginal thing or still geared towards younger people or unserious in a way?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I kind of wanted to flag those comments up, because it's an issue today that we still have where fantasy gets sidelined. And I would say it's interesting now with the development of romantasy, in a way, is answering the fact that the people who grew up with YA don't have the kind of literature for adults now. So we're getting romantasy almost as an answer. Generally, it comes down to this question of kind of highbrow, middlebrow, lowbrow. You get issues of what's high culture, low culture. And even when we say that we're mixing everything, there's still that sense of, oh, it's for children. It's about fairy tales. It's not the real world. So I think it's kind of an ongoing debate we're having. And I think we can also link that to that history of kind of the scientific, realist, logical side, and then the fantastical. And how do you fit those two? Which I think are two elements of the human character that we try and box it in, one or the other. And I really think it's something we're constantly grappling with to work that out. So I hope that answered your question.
Hey, thank you. There might be like an obvious 19th century answer to this, but why Lilith by John MacDonald, why is it subtitled a romance? Is that like a 19th century thing?
That is a good question. I am not a 19th century specialist, so I don't actually have a clear answer for that. I would suggest that at the time, there's often subtitles that are kind of added on to give these little extras. The Glittering Plain also has a subtitle as well. So it's a sense of kind of advertising a bit more about what the text is. But we could also link it to that tradition I mentioned about this idea of historic these histories that are fictional. So Daniel Defoe was writing Robinson Crusoe or Moll Flanders and saying a true story of this, but it's not a true story. So there's that kind of playing with trying to advertise what the text is at the same time. I hope that helps. Potentially someone else might have a better answer than me in the room.
Yeah, just wondering if you could, if you had any kind of examples in mind of a modern fantasy novel that sort of has that kind of moral seriousness and sort of creative talent worked into it.
Yes. So, I mean, Le Guin's Earthsea Cycle, when we're not modern, in the contemporary, like it's not 21st century, is really fascinating, and I highly recommend those books because she really deals with this question of mortality, immortality, kind of forgiveness as well. They're all kind of tying together in the Earthsea series. In terms of 21st century, I mean, so I don't think, in terms of a religious outlook, I have yet to find one that's a truly religious one, but if someone would like to suggest some to me, that'd be interesting. There are some interesting things being done with engaging with the moral outlook of religion from a more secular point of view. So we can think about The Prior of the Orange Tree, which we'll hear about tomorrow. She really does some interesting things in terms of how myths and religions are developed. And there's a similar idea that comes across in Rachel Hartman's books. Has anyone read Rachel Hartman's? It's like Serafina, Tess of the Road. There's really recommend those. If you like Prior of the Orange Tree, read Rachel Hartman. And she, again, is playing with the concept of saints and also dragons. And there's some interesting moral outlooks about logic and kind of creativity and music as well in those books too. So I hope that gives a little hint, but I think basically most fantasy texts, you will find that sense of a moral. But the question of what the moral is something they're kind of working out.
Sorry. Thank you, Katie. A very practical question. I love Morris the man, but I can't stand Morris the writer and the poet. Maybe I was just unlucky. I tried several novels and it didn't work. Is there a novel you would recommend for an absolute beginner which does not sound as if ChatGPT is trying to imitate Thomas Malory?
So this is essentially the struggle with the archaic structures of Morris, isn't it? Yeah. So,
and the syntax, the meandering pace, and
yeah. So, I'm not sure if I'd have a specific one. What I would say is, I think of reading Morris a bit like reading Shakespeare, in that the first Shakespeare you read, you're having to look up half of the words and figure out what's going on. But if you spend your time immersing with it yourself in it, you will gradually find that one day you're suddenly laughing at a joke that you didn't think you'd ever get. So with Morris, I think I'd say it's more you need to give yourself like an hour to sit down and start going with it and see if it starts to make sense, if you pick up his rhythms, and then it kind of comes to you a bit. I would say, I'm not sure I would suggest The Glittering Plain as maybe the first one. I'm trying to remember the name of the other one. There's Well at World's End is also suggested, and then there's The Wood, forgotten the full title. Can someone... Yeah, so, but essentially I would say that what it is you need to give yourself time. You can't expect yourself to be gripped in the first page, but if you give some time aside just to read it, give it a chance. And if you really don't like it, that's fine. It's perfectly fine. You've given it a go. You understand a bit of that, and then you can move on.
Thank you. This is a really fascinating talk. I'm wondering, picking up on the sort of question about contemporary fiction or fantasy fiction, which is dealing with these sort of proto-Christian or Christian themes, what do you make of Susanna Clarke's sort of turn towards some of these things, especially with like Piranesi and that sort of thing? Do you have a thought on that?
So that's interesting because I've read Piranesi, but I'm trying to decide if I hadn't linked it with the Christian viewpoint. So do you have in mind a moment?
Well, she starts, so the book opens with a quotation from The Magician's Nephew.
Right.
Yes. And I think in a sense, it's a broader engagement with this whole conversation about enchantment, disenchantment, mm-hmm. re-enchantment, mm-hmm. Weber and Taylor. Mm-hmm. And then in interviews, she's sort of said fairly explicitly that she's thinking of this through that more, I think, Christian metaphysic. And that she's thinking, especially toward future works.
Yeah.
But it's all, she's not talked a lot about it yet, but I wonder if there's some of that there. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I'm mainly going to go back and reread Piranesi now. I'm in the middle of Jonathan Strange, the long one that I have in three volumes. But yeah, I think that would be really interesting to go back and look. And I think generally in the 21st century, what I'm always looking for with any fiction I'm reading, if it's fantasy, any kind of genre, as I'm always interested in something that's dealing with religious concepts. It doesn't have to be Christian in a complex way. So yes, it's important to bring that secular age of critique, questioning things, and the idea of where does a history and a story come from. But I'm also looking for something that's dealing with the complexity of a God that is incomprehensible, and how do we deal with that with one's personal faith and spirituality. So I will go and reread Piranesi now. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then I think I'll take pity and not ask a question myself. Save that for later. Thank you very much again, and thank you for coming to join us for your fantastic talk.
Thank you.